Today on
Doomed!
If you are listening to this show live right now on July 22nd, 2021, then tomorrow is the opening ceremony of the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. And on today's episode of Doomed with Matt Binder, we will be talking about why they should be abolished. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we're getting into the problematic history of the Olympic Games, what the Games do to its host countries, this year's Tokyo Games, and the growing No Olympics LA movement. And joining me to discuss all of this, one second, let me pull us up on the screen here, is my guest for this episode, Gia Lappi. She is an organizer with No Olympics LA, and she co-wrote, a great piece for The Jacobin called Abolish the Olympics. Great to have you on the show tonight.
Oh, well, thank you for having me and Olympics.
I just want to say that this piece that you you wrote for Jacobin, I was telling you before we started, there's so much in this. It is really a fantastic piece. Everyone should read it. It's linked on the Patreon page and in the description of the YouTube live stream. There's so much in it. We won't be able to get to everything in this episode, but you'd be here for, you would literally do like a whole podcast just on this, like, and never.
Oh, there is a podcast.
There is a podcast. So,
yeah, there is. There's a podcast. And then we sort of updated it and we've been doing a radio show. So
where can people check that out?
Link to that. Yeah. We've got a SoundCloud. I think it's at No Olympics LA on SoundCloud, and we've reposted the episodes there.
Now, Gia, let's start, I guess, at the very beginning, right? The beginning of the Olympics. It's always, you know, I think, and you mentioned this in your piece, you know, people think of, the Olympic Games, the history of it, and they think of, like, you know, the ancient Greeks and the Olympics, and it's sort of like, all right, let's go back and see all this, and you really can't, because the modern-day Olympics doesn't really have any. I mean, sure, the first Olympic Games of the modern day Olympic Games in the late 1800s, first one was in Greece. But other than that, there's really like it seems like it's all just for marketing or PR purposes.
Yeah. And we mentioned that in the article. There was a sentence that I was having trouble with because it like that idea of the games like being, you know, going back to ancient Greece, like the modern day games going back to ancient Greece, to me feels like a very complicated thing in that, like, it is both used for marketing. Like, there's this funny ad, like, by Got Milk or, like, you know, Big Milk, talking about how milk is like the original sports drink. And in that way, using or like kind of like normalizing or like the kind of ancient athlete as this sort of, you know, figure, and that like how that can be used for marketing. And then also, like, I think a big thing there is also sort of normalizing how long, or trying to normalize like how long the Olympics have been around, and how that can really make the abolishments like a less like easy idea to grapple with. You know, if we think right, these are games that have been around since, you know, like whatever, like 700 BC, it becomes a lot harder to believe that they can be like that, they don't have to exist.
Right, but right. That's a really great point, because, you know, if you think about it, with the first, there was only one game in the late 1800s. That's how late it started. Is the first in Greece, And then, of course, it happens every 4 years, the Summer Olympics. Surprise, surprise, there's no real history. I mean, sure, the Winter Olympics comes along in like the early 1900s. I think it's like, what, the 1910s or 20s. But I mean, it's not like it has ties to ancient Greece because they weren't playing in the snow in ancient Greece. So yeah, that's a great point. It really, every 4 years, how many Olympic Games have ever been? Not that many. It's not some long history thing that dates back to 700 BC, like you said.
No, it's not. And it was started by, you know, the modern day games were started by this, like, what my comrade, who I wrote the piece with, called like the proto Proud Boy, Pierre de Coubertin, who really started the games as a way of like basically hyping up like France and like really getting, it was really just like a nationalistic enterprise.
Right, right. Pierre de Coubertin, I have to look into him. He was
a eugenicist.
Jeez, yeah. All right.
Like, yeah, a lot of really nasty quotes. And the Olympics still tweets about him as if he's like, you know, a figure they're proud of. So that, I think, speaks a lot to where they're at. So
wouldn't his like his name sort of give up the whole charade though, that this is back in, you know, ancient Greece, 700 BC? Like, weren't many Pierres running around then?
Right?
You think they would realize this doesn't all add up, but I guess it doesn't really matter.
Nothing they do, I don't think they think there are any consequences. They don't think about anything they do beyond, you know, the moment they're doing it.
Right, right.
Other than, you know, the whole speculative real estate game.
Right. And we'll get into that in a second. Before we move on from like historic Olympic games, I want to get to this because I did not know about this. This was, I don't want to say shocking because it's not a surprise, I guess, but it's still jarring to read about and see. And that is the 1904 games in St. Louis, where they had an event called Anthropology Days. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's even worse than it sounds. Those games were really used. I mean, Pierre de Coubertin in general used sport as a way to sort of, in his mind, like, civilize people. And so, like, think of, like, the worst thing a sideshow could be. And that's what he did in these games and in those games in particular.
So was it like a, cause I'm reading what you wrote in the piece about, and it's basically, indigenous people were brought in to compete against, you know, the Westerners, and they would basically have to play games and play up the whole idea that they're quote unquote savages. It seems like, I think sideshow was a great word for it.
Yeah. And I don't think this made it into the piece, but like, one can argue that the Olympics are still just as racist and like dangerous and like in their own way, like, or like are very clearly still a sideshow for, you know, whatever weird kind of ideals they're still perpetuating.
Right. And when people think about the Olympic torch, they probably don't think about Nazi Germany, but they should. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
If you want to talk about it for 1 second.
Oh yeah, don't worry about it. I totally know all about needing drinks and stuff like that. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I have low blood sugar. I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it.
People tend to think that the torch, like so many kind of like icons the game uses now, goes back a lot farther. But 1936 games are also known as the Nazi Olympics, and the torch was part of those games in Berlin.
Right. And recently, didn't the Olympic Games share something, or I guess they don't really try to hide this part of their history, which I guess it's good they don't hide it, but they certainly shouldn't be, it should be, if anything, I guess a moment to reflect, yet they seem to be promoting it as just another Olympic Games when they bring up the games that happened in Nazi Germany that basically were used by Hitler and his regime to as a propaganda tool.
Yep. Am I frozen?
Yeah, you just froze.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I'm honestly, that works to my benefit in a way, so I can keep eating. Oh, am I totally gone?
Yeah, I took we could fix the I could call you
Okay.
back on Skype if you want, but why don't we just go ahead with this and then we'll reset in a second.
Yeah. They tweeted about those games last year, like completely shamelessly, without any kind of acknowledgement of the history of the games. And the Holocaust Memorial tweeted back and basically called them out for it. And they didn't go so far as to acknowledge or apologize the history of those games. They deleted the tweet, but without any acknowledgement or apology
Right,
about it.
right. So let me actually let before we go into the Tokyo Games, do you want me to? Can I just call? I'll hang up this call and I'll call you right back so we can see if that fixes the video. Or would you rather not have the video? It's up to you.
No, you can call me back.
All right, cool. Let me call you back.
Okay.
One second, ladies and gentlemen. Let's just fix this small Skype issue. Boop, boop, boop. Skype ring is going on. There we go. You're back. And there
Oh,
you are.
great.
Okay, great. So let's now talk about, there's a lot of history, actually. We could continue on, but let's talk about what in general, and this also talks about, the games going back to the beginning, but it also brings the modern games, the current games coming up in Tokyo, and also future games. What does the Olympics do to the host cities? Because I feel like most people, when they think of the Olympics and it's coming to your city, they recall how, their elected officials and all their local businesses, probably, or real estate development, especially, working hard to promote the idea that they should be the host city. Cities run entire marketing campaigns just try to show the IOC that their city is the best city to host whatever Olympic Games they're competing for. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, that's a big question, but I'm gonna answer it hopefully step by step and get to all of it. One I think pro or something to be excited about is that fewer and fewer cities are kind of running those campaigns. People, I think, are starting to get more like are starting to see like how detrimental, hosting the games is for a city, and whether it be for the same reasons that we, oppose the games, or for like budgetary reasons, which is like not our bottom line or like of really interest to us. Like people are like resisting, and fewer cities are even like making that bid or making that effort. That's a big reason why LA was awarded when it was. Like, LA was awarded at the same time as Paris, which got 2024. LA was in the running for 2024 and was awarded 2028. And that's essentially because nobody else wanted to host it then. So in that way, like, yeah, we have something. I think that like I'm like that feels like a big, not win, but it feels like things are looking up in that way.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I remember growing up, like I think it was like even like Chicago not that long ago, like it being a really big deal. I remember like the Obamas like campaigning for Chicago to get the Olympics, and that wasn't, you know, I think, especially as a child, like you're only getting these impressions of what something is, and like these marketing campaigns are a huge sort of way that people become, I think, like sort of subsumed and like in the kind of fake nostalgic promise of what the Olympics bring, and stop really asking questions. Now the big thing is like, what do the Olympics do to their host cities or to the host cities? I think the primary way of like looking at it is that like the Olympics don't bring any new problems to the cities. They just exacerbate ones that are already in existence. And so, you know, police just like, the Olympics bring more police. The Olympics bring, like, with that, like, the national special security event situation, which is one side note, but to the city, they essentially are, like, breeding grounds for, or, like, reasons for gentrification, which, you know, also means police, but means displacement. Means like social cleansing.
Right. And, you know, I feel like an issue that does come with the Olympics that wasn't already there, although I'm sure in some areas it probably would come eventually, displacement of people who live in the areas where the Olympics decides to build its various different stadiums. Like, it always was baffling to me. It never really made any sense why every 4 years these multiple giant stadium, like not giant stadium, but giant stadiums, you know, spring up in these cities that are hosting the Olympics. And it's always like, you know, the marketing and the advertising and the PR going into this is always, oh, look, a new modern track and field stadium for this city. Oh, look, this will become a sports complex after the Olympics. And I feel like almost every time the Olympics comes, they use these facilities, they go, and then these arenas and stadiums just become dilapidated. No one uses them. They just sit there because there aren't that many, whatever that game is, like people to play that game in that city. You know, it seems like, just bizarre to me that these giant buildings just take up all this space in these major hubs every 4 years just to sit there and rot away. It's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre and it's tragic and super violent. When you think of like Pyeongchang and like a sacred ancient forest being completely destroyed to make like way for a ski mountain for the Winter Olympics. That ended up being used like twice and now just sits there completely abandoned. I mean, and you can go like on the internet and basically see in every host city, completely abandoned stadiums where nothing exists except like rot at this point. And another example that I like can bring up is, not only like things can be abandoned entirely, particularly like these huge, sometimes $1 billion builds, but sometimes they can also be privatized. Like when you think of like the 84 games, which happened in LA, the pool that was built for those games ended up becoming like part of USC's like campus. And so what was promised to be like a pool for the community ended up going to a multi-billion dollar institution.
Right.
And it's students. Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, I think, like, you know, we're talking about all of these stadiums that go up every every 2 years. Even crazier, actually, if you think about the Winter Olympics, these specific, like you know, this, you know, a lot of people swim. So, you know, you could use a pool in any city. And fortunately, in the scenarios, it seems like it's not going to the public. But the idea of a public pool facility, high class, you know, up, nice public pool facility, sounds like a good idea. But like when it comes to the Winter Olympics, like how many people are going to be using these like skiing resorts and stuff like that? Like it seems even more specific.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue that it's equally illogical no matter what, because nobody's using them anyway.
Right.
But the Winter Olympics are hilarious to think about. No, we're not. I mean, I think there's no sound logic for the Summer Olympics. And so there's equally no sound logic for like the construction and destruction that happens for the Winter Olympics.
Right. Now it seems like, and you mentioned this in your piece, that, you know, if you're someone who enjoys the Olympic Games, but has an issue with all of these things that happen to all these host cities and the people who are victimized by the Olympics coming to their city, an idea would be to just pick a single location that the Olympics is held every single time there's an Olympic Games, just one location, everything happens there. But, you know, you go into this in the piece that would take away a number of things that really is the purpose of the Olympics, and that is this real estate development, the money that goes into these bidding wars. I mean, do you think that would ever be a thing that the Olympics even look at, or it's just not what they're about?
I mean, the Olympics and really like the IOC has no interest in sports or in athletes. And so I can't imagine a situation or a scenario where that happens, because without the speculative real estate game part of the Olympics and without that sort of source of like capital, the IOC has nothing to stand on.
Right. Now let's get into, because, you know, again, there's another argument there for people who enjoy the Olympics. Oh, but, and you just mentioned that, you know, the IOC doesn't really care about the athletes. And maybe someone would say, you know, no, look at the Olympic Games, the people that all over the world, you know, athletes work hard, to have dreams when they're children to be competing in the Olympic Games. And they're living out their dreams, and it's, you know, nice to see the world come together for competition. But I mean, if anything showed that the IOC doesn't actually care about the athletes, I think this year's games are the perfect embodiment of it. Because while we're talking about all these issues that plague every Olympics that there's been, this year seems to have its own very unique set of problems, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, we're seeing athletes show up and immediately being, taking the flight to Japan and immediately being told, pretty much after taking a test, that, hey, you flew out here for no reason. You can't compete. You've tested positive.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel, you know, obviously very sorry to those athletes, but beyond the kind of like detriment there is like all of like what bringing in, you know, potentially unvaccinated athletes or athletes, you know, who have been infected, and there have been a number of athletes who've tested positive, what that's doing and like how that's endangering like also the citizens in Japan,
right,
is exponentially like worse and more devastating. But yeah, I mean, I think the Olympics have created an environment and like a narrative where they're the only opportunity for an athlete. And like, they really exist because they've sort of created a world where they've defined success, and they've also like created that scarcity. And yeah. And so I think to close off, they've really don't allow athletes opportunities to do anything else.
Right. No, no. Do they, are you saying that they can you expand on that a little bit? What, how do they, you know, they obviously have to force the athletes into specific, you know, to agree to specific terms and such like that. But are you saying that there's certain sports where basically, I mean, this is how I'm interpreting it. There are certain sports where basically, I mean, you watch just during the Olympics, there is no real industry surrounding, you know, like there's basketball in the Summer Olympics, but you know, basketball has a whole industry around it. But then there's like lesser known sports, like, I don't know, discus throwing and things like that, which obviously people work hard on that, but there isn't like a whole industry like the NBA or MLB or NFL or FIFA that surrounds, you know, these smaller sports where pretty much the Olympics is their only shot at accomplishing anything in their sport of choice.
Yeah, that's something that Jules Boykoff, who wrote Power Games, and also an Olympians, and is plug speaking at an event at Stories in Echo Park in Los Angeles tomorrow, along with a number of organizers and tenants and members of an organization called ATTAC, which is Unhoused Tenants Union. Yeah, and they'll all be speaking at Stories tomorrow. And I recommend anyone in LA go, because they'll be a lot more eloquent than I am right now, honestly. but Jules talks about this idea that like there are no, you know, there is no like ESPN like feature for these very specific, you know, or like niche games. And so the Olympics are really their only opportunity for any kind of, if you even want like glory or competition or recognition. And like, these are people who've dedicated their entire lives in a lot of cases to this one sport. And most everything rests on this one, you know, game every 4 years. And so like, what other option do they have other than going to say Tokyo and like being at risk in that way?
Right.
I mean, they have the option to say no.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's incredibly difficult.
Right. I mean, it seems like there's been a lot of issues with the athletes, but let's move on actually to like you mentioned, it's the more, you know, obviously important issue at hand here. And that's the people of the host city, Tokyo. I was reading, I think it's even mentioned in your piece that there was a poll that showed that something like 80 some odd percent of citizens of Tokyo, Japan, did not want the Olympics to happen. That's since COVID, right? Like, they wanted it to be canceled due to the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that poll, I think, was done in May, if I remember correctly. 86% of citizens did not want the Olympics, and they came anyway, and they're there right now. And it's, the IOC really has like complete like impunity. And even if the very corrupt Japanese government said they didn't want the Olympics happening, they did not. But if they had, the Olympics could go on anyway, because after a certain point, it really is like you've signed the soul of your city, or, you know, like any kind of freedom away when you decide to host the Olympics. And something that we've been doing at an Olympics is trying to get the host city contract from someone in local government, but it seems like that has not actually been written, or no matter what sort of requests we've put in, it doesn't seem to exist. And so we have no idea what exactly we've signed over. Like, I don't know if the city council that voted to approve it, because we don't get a say. The citizens never get a say from the get, doesn't know what they've signed over to the IOC yet.
Wow. Wow. We'll talk about the upcoming Olympics in LA in just a second. I just wanted to stick with Tokyo for just another couple of minutes. What's stunning to me is that, you know, in your piece, you break this down too. The Olympics, this year's Olympics, was basically the right-wing government in Japan's way of trying to revive the country in the wake of Fukushima, the nuclear explosion. And, you know, this was, what, back in 2013? The 2013 was, this was when they were awarded the Olympics. Right, right. And, you know, you mentioned that, obviously, this, they're not even, you know, recovered from that actual explosion yet, let alone, you know, thinking about doing the Olympics. And on top of that, this pandemic. And then, you know, you go through a list of different things that have gone wrong here, from various members, like high executives, I guess you can call them, in the Olympic Committee being forced to resign or for various different reasons. For seems like there was sexual abuse charges and misogyny claims, and just, you know, disaster all around. And then it just, you know, I just think about how, you know, they're still calling it the 2020 Olympics too. And if anything, like, could explain why they're doing that, I mean, it seems pretty obvious. All the merchandise is printed up already. Like,
and they're as big of a disaster as, like, everyone remembers last year to be. Yeah, that's funny. It's of course, like everything else with the Olympics and the IOC, it's a branding thing.
Right. Like, why wouldn't you just, you know, it's not 2020 anymore. It's 2021. You think you would call it the 2021 Games, even though
they live
was...
in their own reality.
Right, right.
Like, the IOC just thinks that they can write whatever story, like, and people will somehow buy it.
Right.
And I think fewer and fewer, I think these games in particular, it's like, truly, who wants the games? Like, it's not, I don't think it's a fringe idea that this whole thing is absolutely absurd. And yet they march on and another thing that I didn't point out about both, like, I think this is like an athlete thing and just like a Tokyo and Fukushima in particular environment thing. One, Fukushima is still not livable. It's still toxic to live there. And yet they're hosting the games there. And beyond that, I have not been to Tokyo in the summer yet, but I think anybody who has will tell you that it's probably the hottest place they've ever been. There were a big group of Nolympics members went to Tokyo 2 years ago. And I think despite like how exciting it probably was or would have been to be in Tokyo, nobody wanted to do anything because it was so fucking humid.
Oh, right. Like, right.
Like triple digits, but like air being thick. And that's where the athletes are expected to compete right now.
Right. Not to go into a whole nother sporting event, because again, this is its own, it could be its own whole entire podcast, but this is something quite similar with FIFA's genius decision to have one of the upcoming World Cups in Qatar. It's like, yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
It's something
that, yeah, I mean, that,
it's like, wow. Like, they even had to, they actually moved the Olympics usually happens, the World Cup usually happens, what, in like the summer, right? July or August. And they had to move it to like a totally different season for that specific World Cup because of how ridiculously hot it's going to be.
The whole thing should raise questions about why these organizations or sports organizations choose the cities they choose.
Right, right. Now, before we move on, I just want to quickly mention, I saw this insane story about this man in Tokyo who was previously displaced by the games before this one. I forget what year that was. Was this the 80s, the 90s, 70s? I can't remember. A number of decades back.
The 70s,
right. And he and at the time he said, like, you know, he was being under, which is, you know, kudos to that guy. I guess, you know, the culture there is more understanding. But he was like, oh, I'm, you know, proud. I was proud to have had to do this for the country so they could have these games. And now he's an old man. And he was displaced for the second time by the Olympics this year's games. Like, the same guy displaced by the Olympics twice in his own city. And this time around, I guess he's just had it, especially at the age he's at. And he's just like, this is ridiculous. I can't believe this happened to me again. And, you know, I just wanted to mention that because it's just, you know, it's just ridiculous. Like, it's just so unbelievable that people are expected to just get up and move for an event that literally takes up 2 weeks. Like, what, the competitions or maybe a little bit longer than that, because some games happen before the official opening ceremony, which I don't even, but yeah, it's so crazy. So
I think just like the first games that I really kind of began to understand, like, you know, way back before I was, you know, a part of Nolympics LA, were like the games in Rio and like the, you know, the destruction of the favelas. But I think it's real, and I think most people tend to associate like the violence of the Olympics and like the disaster of the Olympics with those games, and with like that displacement. But I think it's important for people to also know, like, there have been over 2 million people who've been displaced by the games in the last 20 years. So that doesn't even include that first displacement in Tokyo.
Wow. And someone in the YouTube chat, Dub C, says the 76 Olympics put Montreal in debt for like 3 decades. That's, you know, that's another thing too that I guess, like you said, they're catching on. It's starting to catch on with cities, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But like the whole idea of the Olympics coming and being some sort of business boom too, again, for an event that lasts a total of 2 weeks. And addendum for this year's, there won't even be that supposed tourist boom because people aren't even allowed to go to the Olympics this year to spectate because of COVID. But like, it doesn't seem like that ever really works out. It just seems like the host cities give way more, way, 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 way more to the IOC than the IOC gives in return.
Oh yeah. And it's never beneficial for small businesses. It never has been. That's a myth. And like, if you think like in 84, like the small business owners, particularly like Black small business owners, ended up suing the city because of like the broken promises that it had made these kind of mom and pop shops about what the Olympics would do. As far as like tourism goes, like, no, like Tokyo doesn't need more tourism. LA does not need more tourism. Like, there, it's sort of oversaturated as it is.
That's really a great point, because you think if that was the whole appeal, like, why wouldn't they go to a, you know, like a city in an area that's not very developed, where they could be the development, not a place that's already overflowing with tourism and, you know, densely populated. Like, you never hear them going to like
Go to an underrated city.
Right. A place where there's wide open.
No, don't go anywhere. Right.
But I think, you know, you think though, if that was the argument though, they would be going to like, you know, somewhere in Montana or something like that, you know, but they don't.
Yeah, go to Yellowstone with all the billionaires, like, take them out.
Now before we get to your organization, No Olympics LA, I want to make one more point when we talk about people, the people and organizations who benefit. I think we would be remiss to not specifically mention NBC. They push these Olympics, and I'm sure they spend a ton of money to be the sole, at least in the United States, the sole broadcaster of all the Olympic Games, to the point where they like set up live streams for the games that aren't even on TV. It's just like a 24/7 like Olympics live stream for 2 weeks. along with all the other television programming they do preempt on TV to air the Olympic Games. It always baffles me because, yes, there are people who enjoy the Olympics, but it really does seem like a very niche thing. Yet they really do act like it's some big event that the whole country sits down and watches. And it's just like, again, maybe there's certain matches, you know, obviously I'm sure it was the Miracle on Ice, I'm sure was something people all sat around and watched, like specific events. But the idea that they're the entire country like is like can't wait to watch, a random track and field event or something like that. I mean, it's so bizarre how much they push it like that.
Yeah, no, they completely write their own reality and in some ways have enough money to kind of perpetuate the idea that it's real. They're trying to convince people that like they're excited about the Olympics, right, when I don't think that many people would miss them if they were gone.
Right. I mean, I'm sure people would have noticed last year, to be honest. I mean, we did have a year where it was gone, and there was none.
And that's when people were staying home and doing very little, hopefully, anyway.
Right.
And even then, I don't think more than a handful of people was thinking, hey, I wish the Olympics was on right now.
Right. I mean, we do go without an Olympics for 2 years, you know, like there's a gap. Like people, we live, don't we? Now let's talk about No Olympics LA. Now this is for what? It's the 2028 Olympics, right?
Yes.
And what is your organization doing? I mean, obviously the host, you already are going to be the host city. But this is now 7 years out. So what is already going on though there? Like, are there already, I know you mentioned a little bit earlier on that your group tried to look into, some of the details that, you know, the city signed and there's nothing coming up. Is there anything even happening quite yet? Like, you guys are obviously smart for getting ahead of it so early, but is there anything specifically going on that's already affecting the city in terms of the Olympics coming in 2028?
Yes, there absolutely is. The bid here was awarded actually in 2017. So that's 11 years ahead of the games. And since then, and like even before, the city has been criminalizing houselessness. There's one thing in particular that I think is always, to me, like when I learned about this, blew my mind. There, you know, LA has like decent laws like on rent controlled buildings that, you know, were basically buildings built in before a certain year. And there's a way around that, like, ordinance, which is called the Ellis Act, that essentially, like, a landlord cannot, like, forcibly, like, all these things in quotes, because, like, they do so many things that illegally, but, like, displace you unless, and, like, clear out a building, unless that building or that piece of land or property is going to be used to build a hotel. So, like, the incentives to build hotels in the city are so, like, obviously, like, in favor of landowners and landlords, and that, of course, like, feels like a direct sort of, not even response, but like a justification for the games and for development and for displacing people around the city even now. And people, a bunch of people have been displaced because of that. I'm not sure like what your viewership is, or if you talked about like what happened in Echo Park back in March, but there were close to 200 people who in COVID lived in Echo Park and had a really incredible community there. called Echo Park Rise Up, and they were sort of semi-protected because of COVID regulations and were allowed to build that community out. And to whatever degree, you know, this was really followed, like had some protections against police and, you know, being forcibly removed. And then there was Mitch O'Farrell, who's their council person, decided that he was going to renovate the park back in March. And like in less than a week after like making that announcement, people started getting forcibly removed from the park. And a community that had its own garden, they had built their own showers, had their own kitchen. And this was like with zero help from the city, which had shut off that, like that side of the park's bathrooms, was not like providing running water, like would shut off the lights at night. So completely attempted to, or, and then did displace that entire community. And if I'm not, again, I'm not sure, like if you looked at the footage there or like what, cause it, sometimes it's like, I'll talk to people and they have no idea that any of this happened. And it just like blows my mind because for like 3 days, Echo Park Lake, and like the surrounding area was a, it looked like a war zone.
Jeez.
And, it was like, you know, like hundreds of people were arrested. Journalists had their bones broken. Like there were like riot police everywhere. Yeah, it was something that like you almost like have to look at pictures to really understand. And this was because people were trying to protect themselves and protect their neighbors from getting forcibly removed and like put into carceral housing if they so chose. Wow. Housing, which was promised them.
Wow. Now, what are they going to, like, I'm trying to think, like, again, Los Angeles, like we were mentioning before, was a huge city. Plenty of people live there. Where are they even going to build these, like, it's just, I don't get it. Like, and also, LA had they hosted the Olympics before, didn't they? I mean, like, what, in the 80s, I think?
Yeah, 84. And then 32.
Gee, so this is the third time. Well, but let's stick with, you know, because 32 is obviously pretty far back, but 84 is not so far back to the terms of, like, those buildings are probably still there, no? Like, do you, what became of the infrastructure for the Olympics when they came to L.A. in 1984? That, I think we could have sort of a, we could see what's going to happen based on that, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean that like the Coliseum, well that was actually for the other games, but yeah, I mean like I mentioned like the example of the pool. This Olympics, I think like the Olympics in 84, their whole kind of like selling point, or like they were, you know, in scare quotes, like the first profitable Olympics, and like the money that was left over from those games was used to start like the LA 84 Foundation, which is essentially like a real estate fund, like nonprofit again in scare quotes, you know, right, that is selling the idea of like youth sports as a justification for even the games now, and is really just like a real estate investment company, or, you know, has millions of dollars invested in Blackstone and very little in youth sports. Yeah, so that the games, the 84 games are really sold as like the game, the profitable games, like the first like capitalist games. And these games now are kind of like riding on the idea of being like a no-build Olympics. So technically using already existing facilities, but SoFi Stadium, which is in Inglewood, was built coincidentally, like, and announced right around the time that the Olympics were, right, and just finished, you know, after killing a few construction workers in, you know, the process, and being like, and continuing construction through all of COVID because it was essential to open for no one. It was built in Englewood, which is a predominantly black and brown community, or neighborhood, or actually city, because it's actually its own city. But SoFi is now like the world's most expensive stadium. It was built by the same people who built the stadium in Tokyo, but really, and so like LA is being sold as a like no build Olympics, but it's also really resting on something like the like SoFi Stadium. And now Steve Ballmer, who owns the Clippers, is building a stadium right next to SoFi and displacing, many people in the process.
Wow.
But
That no, that thing that you just said where, like, they try, it sounds like they are starting to and we've basically started off with you saying this at the very top of the our discussion. It does seem like they are becoming more aware of the perception. I don't think I'm sure you agree that they actually care. It's just that they realize that the perception of these things is starting to, I mean, they're caring about the perception because the reality of the situation is starting to catch up with them. And we could leave it with this, and how you mention in your piece for the Jacobin that the latest location for the games is the 2032 Olympic Games in Australia. And why is that a unique announcement they're about to make? You mentioned in your piece. But I want you to sort of cap it off here.
Why
Oh, like
Australia?
the 2032 games in general, because you mentioned how there's this Olympics is just going to be announced. The host city will be announced, and there was
They
no,
just announced it.
yeah, and there was no bidding war, like they just.
Oh. Yeah. Essentially, I mean, and there was no real like pomp and circumstance as far as like the process goes, because, well, for one, the city doesn't, or like the, the citizens don't have a say anyway, and so it really felt like an under the table deal, and everyone else pulled out. I don't know if that's what you're
Yeah,
getting at,
no,
but
right. Because, that's, I mean, to me, that shows exactly what's going on in terms of, like, what are they going to do next? Like, what are they going to do after the 2032 games? It's becoming clear that, like, there's no cities that want this anymore. Like, when you have when you are used to these big bidding wars and all these cities competing for your event, and then all of a sudden, the next one that you need to schedule, only one city wants a part of it. Once you have that event in that city, what's next? Like what happens from there?
LA and Paris were the only two left, and now it's down to one. And I honestly cannot tell you what is going to happen, but it really does feel like the IOC is crashing and burning and doesn't really know how to figure it out. They're again like so delusional that they might do it to themselves. We might not have to work to abolish the Olympics. Like they might just burn themselves out. But like truly, I don't think we as an organization recognize that enough. Like they're doing the work for us so often. And then these, of course, like Tokyo just made it so much more obvious. And it has and really just proved the like what we've been saying for so long, but made it, a lot more obvious. And,
Right.
now again, it doesn't really feel like a fringe idea.
Right. I think there's no better way to end this than that quote that the Olympics, the IOC might abolish the Olympics themselves. Really, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Where can people find more information about your organization and what you guys are doing?
So follow No Olympics LA on Instagram, on Twitter. again on SoundCloud if you want to listen to the radio programs, which are really good, really, really good. I'm not involved in the production, but the people who are the coolest. Follow us there. And if you're in LA, there's an event tomorrow with Jules Boykoff and a ton of other really like important and like just.
That sounds good to me.
Go. Like, if you're in LA, Stories is hosting an event or a panel, and it's going to be interactive. And so, if you have any questions or if you want to share your own experiences, like, that'll be part of the whole thing.
Gia Lappi, organizer with No Olympics LA. Check out her piece in the Jacobin. Link is in the description to this YouTube live stream and on the Patreon, and I'll include it in the podcast description when the podcast version of this interview goes up. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Man, I can't get over some of this stuff that I was reading about the Olympics. I mean, it is we didn't even get to the vast majority of it. Like, we just basically gave you guys a quick overarching summary of the main situations. There's just so much going on there. And the Olympic opening ceremony for Tokyo Games is tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, we're going to go to the second half of the show where I have honestly, this might be one of the best. I shouldn't say that because then I'm going to obviously not live up to expectations. So I don't know if this will be the best second half of the show we'll ever have, but the stories I want to talk about should potentially provide some really good material. So let's get to the second half of the show. Before I do, patreon.com/MattBinder. To support this show. Folks, we received a few new patrons over the past week. And as I always do, I want to shout those people out because obviously they are a huge part of the program. Hold on, let me get this up here. Where is the list of patrons? Come on. One second. Here we go. What was last Thursday? The 15th, right? Okay. So joining the Patreon since the last show last week, Vince, thank you so much for becoming a patron. Mitch W., thank you for supporting the show. Joshua S., thank you. Lisa L., I appreciate you becoming a patron. Anthony D., Soy B, Chase B, and Helen, thank you all for becoming a patron. I appreciate it so much. Like I mentioned at the beginning of this month, July saw a number of patrons having to, for various financial reasons or otherwise, leave this, were unable to continue supporting the show. So we're almost back, thanks to all of you, to our previous peak. We're almost literally like a quarter. We're about a quarter of the way for like this show to be like a self-sustaining thing where I could A, hire people. B, I would very much like to bring a co-host for a second weekly program. And we're like a quarter of the way to like really building out this show. I mean, obviously, quarter of the way sounds far, but it also to me sounds close. Quarter is not very much, 25%. So, folks, if you could afford to do so, patreon.com/MattBinder. If you can't afford to do so, please don't worry about it. Take care of yourself, take care of your family, do what you need to do. If you ever have some extra money and want to support this show, you could become a patron. Or if you want to give a one-off and you're watching the live stream right now, youtube.com/MattBinder or twitch.tv/MattBinder, come on over to the YouTube live stream where you can drop a super chat, which is basically like a one-off donation. I will read all comments connected to a super chat for sure. You can also support this show by leaving a iTunes, no more iTunes, Apple Podcasts review, or leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. There's a lot of reviews out there. For links on where you could do that, ratethispodcast.com/doomed will provide you with a list. That's ratethispodcast.com/doomed. Seriously, just especially Apple Podcasts, it's a big help in getting this show out there. Just go there, hit how many stars you think the show is worthy of. Leave a quick written review if you have a couple extra minutes. Really appreciate it if you do that. If you want to listen to the audio version of this program, doomedcast.com is where you'll find it. Follow me on social media at Matt Binder on Twitter, Instagram. Just search Matt Binder wherever you're on, and you'll probably find me on there. How much I use those platforms is another question, but I'm definitely always using Twitter and YouTube. So those are the main two. And I'm simulcasting on Twitch, so that too. What else? I think that's all for now, folks. Before going to the second half of the show, give me a quick second to get myself a drink, because I forgot my soda, if you can believe it. So I'm like bustling along here. I've got low blood sugar at this point. I wanted to read a quick podcast review to let you guys know, give you an example of some of the reviews I get. Here's a quick one. Doomed, laugh out loud and informative. Thanks, Matt, for keeping us informed of all the crazy right-wingers and misinformation and still keeping it light and entertaining. That's from Best Bingo Game Out There. I don't know if I've already read this one, but here's another one. Future Tim says, Matt Binder is doing good work. Anybody saying otherwise is probably QAnon, LOL. I love that one. All right, so was it yesterday? No, it was, all right, so Wednesday night. I don't even know if I should date this, because I got to cut this and get it up ASAP tomorrow. But here we go. This is the fun topic I'm talking about. So Wednesday night, I'm on Twitter, and all of a sudden, I see this crazy claim that I've never heard before starts spreading around. This rumor has never gone anywhere before. I've never heard any of this ever through the grapevine before just a few nights ago. It just seemingly came out of thin air all of a sudden. And it was this tweet. The first place I saw it was this tweet by a YouTuber named Jackson Hinkle. Is that his name? Hinkle, yes, Jackson Hinkle. And I'm honestly not that familiar with him. According to a lot of people, he has been feuding with TYT recently. I know nothing about this. I have no interest in these online feuds. Clueless, completely. Never even heard of this guy. Maybe I think I saw his name come up because there was this Vosh debate he did going around. I didn't watch it, but I saw that going around. So I have this tweet from Jackson Hinkle that was going viral just a few nights ago. Here it is. AOC co-owned the restaurant she used to bartend at, and she worked on a foreign affairs issues for Senator Ted Kennedy before running for Congress. Justice Dem's strategist told AOC not to talk about either occupation during her campaign and to instead claim she was just a bartender. And then he has a screenshot of an article saying Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was working behind a bar. She had helped launch Flats Fix, the taco and craft cocktail spot in Manhattan, while pondering what to do next. Now, here we go. Let's get to this right away. So I forgot to grab the tweet. Let me see if I can find it really quick. But let me take the most obvious claim that we could debunk. Let me take that one first. And that is her time working for Senator Ted Kennedy. And this is true. AOC did work for Senator Ted Kennedy. But here's the thing. This was not some sort of secret. I could do a screen share right now, actually. Let me do that really quick. Where is this? Okay, here we go. Let's do a screen share really fast. I quickly searched AOC's Twitter handle on Twitter and typed in Kennedy. And what came up is these tweets. One from December 2017. Fun fact about U.S. immigration policy from my experience working with Ted Kennedy. Another one from February of 2018. I have a degree in economics and other international relations from Boston University. Before that, MIT honored my work in microbiology. I started under Ted Kennedy. Here's another one. May 2018. About 10 years ago, I worked for Ted. About 10 years ago, I worked in Ted Kennedy's Foreign Affairs, Immigration, and Constituent Office. I regularly fielded calls from panicked mothers who came home to missing family members. ICE was created in 2003, along with the Patriot Act. There was a weapon waiting for a tyrant. Here's another one. August 2018. As an intern, I learned a lot about the power of humanity and government through his, with Ted Kennedy. She's talking about McCain there. June 2019. I am always proud of my work in restaurants. I also worked for Senator Ted Kennedy. Here's another one. February 2020. I'm a former multi-year intern for Senator Ted Kennedy. Big shocker. She interned for Senator Ted Kennedy. She was a college student in Massachusetts. You could certainly criticize and critique many aspects about Ted Kennedy's career, but he certainly was seen as an early progressive icon, and she interned for him. Oh my God, big revelation you could have uncovered by typing in the Twitter search bar from AOC, Kennedy. Now back to the claims that, the other claim that, Hinkle, makes here. And this is, and I should be fair, these are claims he's sharing. He is claiming that, he learned about this from people. AOC co-owned the restaurant she used to bartend at, and she worked on foreign affairs issues for Senator Ted Kennedy before running for Congress. Okay, but the restaurant one's what I'm focusing on now. Here is the info there. I looked into this that night, Wednesday night. And I looked into this issue because I had never heard that she co-owned the bar. Flats Fix is a known taco bar. In Union Square, Manhattan. I'm very familiar with it. In fact, I've been there before. I used to work very close by to that place. It is connected to a famous Union Square coffee shop called, people in New York, some people call it Coffee Bar. It's coffee shop. And it's a longtime fixture, even though Coffee Bar closed in 2018, I believe. But the Taco Bar is still there. And the owners of the coffee shop also own the taco bar, Flats Fix, where AOC worked. And they also own a number of other restaurants throughout the city. There's one that's very famous, if you're a New Yorker at least, Live Bait, which also recently closed after becoming the second location for Flats Fix. So that didn't work out. But the original Flats Fix, the one AOC worked at, is still open. Now, if you look up these restaurants, they're very well known. There's been numerous press coverage on these restaurants over a long course of time because, again, fixtures in New York. The coffee shop is owned by three people. One of the companies attached to it is called Theme Theme Bar or something like that. Theme Foods. That's it. Theme Foods. Theme Food, I should say. And this is a company that's been around for decades. Live Bait was opened in 87, 3 years before, 2 years before AOC was born. Coffee Bar was opened up in 89 or 90, I believe, which would be a year after AOC was born. Obviously, the taco place opened up much after. AOC obviously was old enough to work there. But I've never come across anything claiming AOC co-owned the bar. So I shared all this information. I shared the liquor license information where, again, AOC is not attached. But, of course, not all the owners are attached to the liquor license information. But, again, the same three people who've owned all these restaurants for decades comes up. Dave Weigel of the Washington Post went a step further the next morning because he saw this same claim going around. And he got a pretty hardcore open-shut case proof that this claim is bullshit because he went ahead and he called the restaurant. And the staff confirmed that Ocasio-Cortez never owned or co-owned the restaurant, obviously, because, again, this is all public information. And also, as he points out, this information could be confirmed by her 2018 financial declaration, which all candidates need to file. And we could see how much AOC actually made. Let me make it a little bit smaller and center it. Right there, her coffee shop wages that year was $3,588 earned income. Her salary was more because she was taking money from the Ocasio-Cortez campaign, which candidates are allowed to do. So we know her financial details. We know from decades of press coverage of these restaurants. We also had a hit piece in the New York Post a couple of years ago where a worker who did not like AOC claimed that a manager there had to give her extra tips because she claimed AOC didn't split her tips fairly enough. Again, if you own a restaurant, you're not going to be overruled by another manager, and you certainly wouldn't be handling out your own bar tips. Just really bizarre. But see, I don't really care about Hinkle. What I care about is where he heard this claim. I mean, Hinkle's just some random YouTuber. He's not even like a known YouTuber. He's not like a big, has some big fan base or something. He's just a nobody. Not to knock him. It's just like, I care about the big picture here. And Hinkle is not the big picture, even though he's the source of this information going viral. So I looked further into this, and where did Hinkle say he heard this from? Because again, this Hinkle isn't the direct source. He goes on to say, Paula Jean Swearingen just confirmed that AOC was a co-owner of the restaurant on a live stream. And I have multiple Justice Democrat contacts who have communicated this to me in the past as well. Now, that last part, I don't believe. Because, full disclosure, I have worked with the Justice Democrats before. And I've never heard this. And as both a journalist and someone who has worked with them prior, on a freelance basis, you know, but I'm familiar with a number of people there. I've worked with them on campaigns when I worked for the Cynthia campaign. I was shocked that this would come from that, and I don't believe it. So I'm pretty sure he's referring to Paula Jean Swearingen that second time around, because that's what he says he heard it from. Paula Jean Swearingen just confirmed that AOC was a co-owner of the restaurant on a live stream. What live stream? What live stream? What live stream is he talking about? Now, Paula Jean Swearingen was on a live stream that night. Luckily, she was only on one live stream, so it makes it really easy to know what live stream Hinkle was talking about. And so I searched more on Twitter, and I noticed that everybody else who was also sharing these rumors, these unsubstantiated rumors about AOC owning the bar she worked at. And I remember why this is a big deal to them. The idea is AOC lied about her history in order to appeal to voters, to progressives, as some sort of champion of the working class, because she too was part of the working class. She was a worker, who blue-collar worker working behind a bar. If she was a co-owner of the bar, that totally changes the dynamic of her story. And obviously, she would have lied about her story, right? So where did this unsubstantiated rumor come from? From a user who also found out about this rumor from the same source as Kinkle. Paula Jean Swearingen said this on Jimmy Dore's stream earlier. Shocking that this would start from the Jimmy Dore show. And by shocking, I mean not surprising at all. Now, Jimmy Dore locks up his live streams right after the live stream ends. And to get this live stream, you have to be a paying subscriber of the program, which is cool. No problem with that. I mean, I think it's a bit weird that you wouldn't at least make portions of these interviews public. I know he does cut segments, but he also leaves a lot locked behind that paywall. But, you know, that's his prerogative. It's his show. It's his way of making money. That's fine. But I was really interested in seeing this Paula Jean Swearingen clip. Because to me, it's important here. Jimmy Dore has Paula Jean Swearingen on his show, and she apparently says this. Now, it's his show. He didn't say it. I want to be clear. Jimmy Dore did not say this. But it started, this unsubstantiated rumor, this what we now know is a falsehood, was said on his show, the Jimmy Dore show. I know on my show, and on any other program, even Jimmy Dore's fans, if they heard a lie about someone they supported, or just a lie in general about a cause or anything of the sort, on MSNBC, CNN, whatever, TYT, Young Turks, Majority Poor, whatever it is, you would want that falsehood corrected, right? And you would expect someone to correct that if it was their show, or at least stop and question where they got this information from. So to me, it was imperative I find out what Jimmy Dore says before and after Paula Jean allegedly states this. Now, to do this, I needed to subscribe to Jimmy Dore's show. I'm not going to do that. But I have people who are fans of my show and the Majority Report who apparently do have access to Jimmy Dore's paid subscription feed. And so I have for you, I have not seen this anywhere else, I have for you this Paula Jean Swearingen clip. We are going to watch it right now. We're going to hear what question brings forth this alleged falsehood. The falsehood is true. It is true that this falsehood was stated, but allegedly Paula Jean says it. So we're going to find out where this falsehood came from and what Jimmy Dore says right after it's stated. Let's listen to this clip right now.
And so, just in closing, what do you think happened to the Justice Democrats? Why do you think they don't strategize and vote as a bloc like the Tea Party did? Because they have all the power. They can block any bill and every bill if they wanted to get their demands met, yet they won't do it.
Is Dore serious right now? This isn't even what I'm even discussing here. But what? The Tea Party was quite large. Is Dore alleging that the Justice Democrats' numbers are enough to block? I mean, let me look this up. Let's find out right now. I'll do this live right now here on the show. No, that's not true. If every Justice Democrat, there's, I believe, 10 of them right now, voted against the Democratic Party, Republicans still have enough as of right now. Obviously, this could change due to vacancies, but as of right now, that's not true. Justice Democrats don't have the numbers the Tea Party had yet. But that's not the point of this. Let's continue.
Do you think that is? I say it's because they're corrupt, because they get the speaking fees, they got book deals, they don't want Nancy Pelosi to fund somebody who's going to primary them, and then all they have to do is stay 5 years, and they get retirement for they get a pension for the rest of their life. So they're doing this for their own personal. So that's corrupt. That's the definition of corrupt. In fact, that they're being dishonest for their own personal gain. Is that what you think happened?
I think it is personal gain.
For those you don't know, Paula Jean Swearingen is a 2018 primary candidate. She primaried Joe Manchin for Senate in 2018. She was covered in that Netflix documentary along with AOC. Bernie Sanders supported her. She was a progressive in West Virginia. She ran again in 2020, this time as the Democratic candidate against the Republican senator. She lost that too. I always assumed that Swearingen had some good politics from what I've understood about her. She came out. The reason Jimmy Dore had her on the show is because she came out and said she was leaving the Democratic Party to join a third party, the People's Party. That's a whole another segment, a whole another episode. People's Party has a array of issues and problems. Also, I don't think they're even that progressive. But that aside, that's who Paula Jean Swearingen is. That's why she's on the Jimmy Dore show. Let's get to it.
Shoricott Tripodi and Corbin Trent were trying to formulate another PAC, and let's get another AOC elected in West Virginia, and I wouldn't support that. I think they just follow the money and they follow the buzz, and it really wasn't intended to elect real public servants. I think that AOC is friends with those folks way back, and I think they used us to make sure that AOC got elected. Even before, they were pulling out of our campaigns. They promised all these services. And right toward the end, before AOC's primary, they were taking everything away from us and they were vesting everything in her. And I think the first intent was to get AOC elected. And to be honest with you, I don't think the Democratic Party would have let her through the gate.
I'm sorry. This is a someone who's run two campaign, a candidate, two-time candidate, Senate runs, doesn't understand how these campaigns work. Just as Democrats don't have unlimited resources. The reason you would pull out of supporting some of the campaigns that you endorsed and put all resources into one campaign towards the very end, like Paula Jean Swearingen just said, is because the other campaigns are flailing. The writing's on the wall. And it would be a waste of your resources to spend the money on a campaign that is doomed. A campaign that is not going to win at this point, no matter what resources you pump into it. So you take those resources and you take them out of the wasteful campaign and you put it all into the campaign that you're seeing, oh my God, we have a chance to win this one, which clearly they did and clearly they were right. Let me pull this up right now. Paula Jean Swearingen in the 2018 election, she was a primary candidate against Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin won that with over 112,000 votes, nearly 70% or 69.9% of the vote. Paula Jean Swearingen got a 0.1 percentage over 30% and less than 50,000 votes. All the money in the world at that point wasn't going to save the campaign. If it was a close race, if you guys were just a few percentage points away from each other, I would understand being upset about this. But that's not what happened. They took the money from your campaign and the resources and the time and the whatever else they were putting into it. And they saw AOC was about to beat Joe Crowley and they put it all into that. And guess what? It paid off because AOC beat Joe Crowley. It's that simple.
She pretended to be an ordinary person. She pretended to be a bartender when she is co-owner of the bar.
There we have it. There we have it. Let me rewind it a little bit. There it is.
Party would have let her through the gate.
There it is.
She pretended to be an ordinary person. She pretended to be a bartender when she is co-owner of the bar. She never told us that she worked for the Kennedys.
She mentioned the Kennedys thing multiple times on her Twitter feed, stepping back to 2017. The year before her election was even happened in that June of 2018. This is just astounding. And I would love to know where she got this come on the bar thing from.
Her mother in an interview said that she wanted to be president one day.
Kids say that all the time. And that's the parents' job to say, oh, I remember. That's what it happens. Kids say that all the time. If you're a kid and you say you want to be president one day, does that mean you're an insider and you have some sort of connections? This is ridiculous. Are you kidding me?
She had decided she wanted in politics, and she laid the framework of acting like she was one of us. When you had real struggling people, not only the candidates, but people behind the scenes.
We saw she was making less than $30,000 for the year she filed when she was running as a candidate. Living in New York City. Less than $30,000. Are you kidding me? She wasn't really struggling? What?
It really believed that we could get real people, public servants elected. And then now she's just doing what she lied about. I think she lied to get there. And I'm disappointed. I'm very disappointed. But now I think we have suffered a lot of losses in this movement. I'm stubborn, but I'm also a mother and grandmother. I cut my leg off from my kids.
Assuming,
I'm not done.
I'm assuming I'm Jimmy Dore is going to butt in.
But
soon.
I'm not going to invest
right?
in people anymore.
And ask for some more information, right?
Do
about
some
all
good,
those claims
honest
she just
work
made, right?
And making sure
Let's
that
see
we
what
have
Jimmy
a
Dore
government
says.
That serves us.
His show, right?
And it's going to take an overhaul, and it's going to take a new national party.
Here we go.
And I hope everybody listens to what I'm saying. I've been there. I've been into the internal grind work, and I know how dishonest these people are. Mm-hmm. It's beat me down, but it's going to pick me back up, and nobody should feel beat down right now. We can, excuse me, a nap. We can build a new party, and we can build a government that serves us, and we can get actual people servants elected. Mm-hmm. But we've got to quit putting everything behind these dishonest people and fighting people that are designed to fight us.
Well, 62% of Americans are in favor of a third party. That's unbelievable. And
that's what he takes away from this. The interview ends right there. That's it. He says goodbye to her. This is stunning. Stunning. All those claims just made, and he doesn't even for a second say to himself, even as someone who I know he doesn't like AOC, you think even those claims would light a fire in you to go, in his brain going, I don't like AOC, and I haven't heard this. Whoa, Paula Jean, wait a second. She owned the bar that she claims she worked at? You got to tell me more about this. I've never heard anything about this before. Nothing. 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 And I don't know about his claim there that 62% of Americans want a third party. Maybe it's true. I don't know. I'm not against the third party. The current system currently makes it very difficult, but I'm not opposed to it, but that's besides the fact. This is truly stunning. And, after all this came out, Hinkle, who really made this claim go viral, came out with a sort of retraction. A tweet of mine repeated a claim from sources at the Justice Dems, including a former JD candidate. I want to tell you right now, remember how I said before that I didn't believe he had Justice Democratic sources and that he heard it solely from Paula Jean Swearengen while listening to the Jimmy Dore show? I can tell you that this really affirms my beliefs, because when he says a tweet of mine repeated a claim from sources at the Justice Dems, including a former JD candidate, by saying including, I mean I think he means solely a former JD candidate. And when he says a former JD candidate, he's referring to Paula Jean Swearengen. So a tweet of mine repeated a claim from sources at the Justice Democrats, including a former Justice Democratic candidate, that AOC co-owned the bar she worked at in New York. This statement has been disputed. No, it hasn't been just disputed. It's been outright debunked. But the statement has been disputed, leading me to remove the tweet until there is documentary evidence beyond my sources to prove it. Well, there's never going to be any documentary evidence because apparently you don't trust your sources, which means you shouldn't have shared any of the bullshit you shared to begin with, because it created an entire firestorm online of people sharing this bullshit over and over. I just saw it going around, and I still see people sharing it because, of course, once it gets out there, no one ever reads the retraction or the correction when it comes to these bullshit, unsubstantiated conspiracy theories and falsehoods and misinformation. You already did the damage. Really stunning. Really stunning. And I should say, I was... where is this? I was on... Someone told me that I was on Rising this morning. And I was like, what? I was not on Rising this morning. I did not do an interview with Rising this morning. But apparently, I was talked about.
A YouTuber took down a viral tweet yesterday claiming that Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez co-owned the bar she worked at in New York. Despite it being obviously false, the story continued to spread.
This is Ryan Grimm.
Journalist Matt Binder replied to the initial claim.
No, Ryan Grimm, no! It's Binder!
Obviously false, the story continued to spread. Journalist Matt Binder replied to the initial claim saying, quote, the bar was owned by three people who run a company called Theme Food, Inc. He even pulled up the liquor license for the bar, Flats Fix, which shows Theme Food, the company that owns the bar, was founded in 1986, 3 years before AOC was born. Washington Post reporter Dave Weigel even called the bar to confirm that it was untrue. This is an interesting story, not because it's worth fact-checking it, because it's not. You know, journalists can't be tasked with fact-checking every random claim that's made on Twitter. And it's also not interesting to just dunk on a YouTuber or a person who happened to make a claim. People make false claims all the time. Yeah. What's so interesting here is the legs that this claim got.
Right.
Like the fact that a Washington Post reporter and Matt Binder are actually digging in and debunking this. And also that it won't matter. Like, I suspect that over the next year or so, you will...
Right. I wanted to play that clip, not just to point out that I was both referred to on Rising by Ryan Grimm, and he messed up my last name. But but the reason is because I agree with that, but I think that's just one of the main issues. To me, the reason I'm covering this is not to dunk on Hinkle, of course, because, I mean, again, who is he? There's a nobody in the big picture. But his claim did go viral, and it meant you had to refute it. You had to debunk it because it was a false claim. But also what's important to me and why I covered it and why the bulk of this segment was on Door is because that's the important part. Where is this stuff coming from? And why is it that time and time again, when a certain subsection of this left that's susceptible to these falsehoods and these random through the grapevine rumors and conspiracy theories, why is so much of that stuff funneled to them by the Jimmy Dore show? I mean, I want to really understand what's going on here. Because it is super problematic. We're getting to it's getting to be a real issue. That there seems to be one show that is accounting for a large swath of what an entire subsection of the left is pushing when it comes to false information. All right, folks, give me a minute to get a drink. And we got tons of things to talk about, tons of stories. I'll give you a little taste. We got these crazy rumors that spread about AOC online this past week. We got an interesting study on police officers who are dying in the line of duty, and how they're dying exactly shouldn't shock you, but that's certainly not how the police are framing it. And what else? There's another one I had, right? There's a few, actually. Oh, let me drop this. the caller system. How did I forget? I will be opening up the phone lines on Skype. Call in, download Skype if you don't already have it. If you do, just open up your Skype, search Doomed Live, and you could call into this program. All right, folks, going to the second half of the show now. You can stick around if you're watching it on the live stream. You can stick around, obviously, if you're a patron. If you're not watching live, if you're not a patron, then I will see you all next time on Doomed.